Dusty roads? Spray some oil on it. What's the worst that could happen? I'm Joe Foljam.
This town may be a toxic, smoldering, hole-ridden ash pile, but it's my toxic, smoldering, hole-ridden ash pile. I'm Torrin Atkinson.
Newsflash, Nazis are jerks. I'm Kevin Leeson, and this is Caustic Soda.
A ghost town is an abandoned village, town, or city. A town often becomes a ghost town because the economic activity that supported it has failed, or due to natural or human-caused disasters such as floods, government actions, uncontrolled lawlessness, war, or nuclear disasters.
So we're not talking about haunted towns.
We're not talking about the remains of a town that's been destroyed in a spiritual form.
Yes, it now exists.
That would be a ghost
town.
You can
just walk right through all the walls and everything. No.
This isn't Casper's town.
Casper, the friendly ghost town?
Mm-hmm, exactly. Casper's hometown?
Casper, Indiana. I don't know if that exists.
Sounds good, though.
All right.
The term is sometimes used to refer to cities, towns, and neighborhoods which are still populated but significantly less so than in years past. So you can have ghost towns with a few people in it.
A few stragglers, a couple of homeless people, people who've moved into abandoned
recalcitrant ne'er-do-wells.
Indubitably.
I just prefer to think of them as extremely thrifty.
Yeah,
I'm sure the rent is quite low in a ghost town.
All to myself.
Well, you know, in this day and age where you can, you know, do everything over the internet and you can work from home and whatnot, you know, moving to a town where you don't have to pay any rent might not be a bad idea.
Well, it only works if you get internet service in your ghost town.
Ooh, snap.
Yeah. Here's a good quote from a Wired.com article, "Welcome to Armageddon, USA," which I believe was about one of the towns that we'll be mentioning.
That was the place that became a ghost town because everybody hated the name.
No one wanted to move into Armageddon for some reason.
For all the famed cities with thousands of years of continuity, Paris, London, Cairo, Athens, Rome, Istanbul, most cities just stop.
Isn't Istanbul now Constantinople?
No,
that's nobody's business but the Turks.
Thank you. Thought I was going to have to do that myself.
Most ghost towns aren't simply another boom town gone bust. It's emblematic of what happens when a modern city dies.
Okay.
A few people stay behind, trying to hold on to what they can. They are the new homesteaders, trying to civilize a wasteland at the end of the world.
Ooh, Fallout! Fallout!
Whose quote was that?
It's a bit hyperbolic.
Yeah, it sounded a touch dramatic.
And the word origin for ghost town comes from Old English ghost, ghast, which means soul, spirit, life, breath. Town comes from Old English tun, meaning garden or homestead, and later a group of houses. And the word abandon comes from an old French word meaning surrender, from a, which means at or to, and abandon, meaning power or jurisdiction.
You know, much like the Inuit have many words for snow, the French have many words for surrender. It was just too easy, but I could not go there. I couldn't not go there.
We would get comments if we didn't say something.
I can't believe you didn't make a joke about France surrendering. Yeah. That's what would happen.
I know. It's true. I couldn't bear the avalanche of emails.
We love you, France. We know that you're a strong, hearty people.
We love your many
your
pastries.
Share of military victories.
Surrender?
The phobia, there's autophobia. Do you guys know what that is?
It's probably not fear. Well, I'm going to say it's fear of cars. Fear of cars. But I think it's probably a trick question.
No, it's that movie about the guy from Hogan's Heroes who, you know, got caught up in that.
Or it's
Greg Kinnear? No? No one else? No one?
Oh, yeah. Autoerotic asphyxiation phobia.
Well, do you know what auto means in that sense then?
Self.
There you go. Perfect.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So this auto is Greek for self. So autophobia is the fear of being by yourself.
Oh,
being alone.
Okay.
We all have that fear deep down inside, Torrin?
Yes.
Except for you.
I revel in it. I got to get out of here. Kinophobia.
It's the fear of movement?
Moving? It's the fear of Catherine Keener.
Fear.
She's very intimidating.
It's the fear of being a very good student?
It's the fear of that game you play in at lottery centers.
Kino.
Oh, there you go.
Kino is Greek for empty.
Oh.
Kinophobia is the fear of voids or empty spaces.
I thought it was like kinesthetics, so it was motion.
It's K-E-N-O. It is spelled exactly like the game.
I see.
Similar to agoraphobia.
Yeah, maybe fear of going outside would be agoraphobia. Whereas kinophobia is the fear of voids.
How many voids do you encounter in your life?
I was about to say. It's not one that seems to come up.
Like, if you have that evil demonic closet, like in The Evil Dead, you know, with a big swirling void, you should be afraid of that.
Abnormally afraid of that, though?
Okay.
Maybe they just don't like to look up at the night sky.
So we're not really going to... Like, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of ghost towns we could talk about.
Okay.
But I've chosen the most caustic soda-ish.
Yeah. Which is the whole point.
In some cases, literally.
Oh, nice. Okay. I like to hear this.
And the first one is going to be Wittenoon, Western Australia. Founded 1947.
Oh, so relatively recently founded.
The function was asbestos mining.
Ah, I see where this is going.
The maximum population was 20,000 or more.
Uh-huh.
The current population is 8.
8.
8 people. In the 1950s, they mined blue asbestos, which...
That's sad asbestos?
Which, as if you're a bizarro, you know it will give you beneficial effects. Sorry, it hurts bizarros, but it gives normal Kryptonians beneficial effects.
Oh, yeah.
Also known as crocodolite.
Crocodolite.
Blue asbestos.
Okay.
Crocodolite. Or crocodolite.
Is that that drug that they're smoking and injecting in Russia that gives you the scaly skin?
And that's something else.
It's crocodile.
The first case of asbestosis at Wittenoom occurred in 1946, before even the town was founded.
Right. When people were just hanging out.
Yeah. Although it was not conclusively diagnosed until much later. A government medical officer warned of the dust levels in the mine and the mill, the lack of extractors, and advised that the mine would produce the greatest crop of asbestosis the world has ever seen.
Ooh, that's a little doomsday call that turned out to be correct, I'm guessing.
He also advised the Wittenoom mine management that men exposed would contract chest disease inside of 6 months.
Wow. Well, that's a short amount of time to get lung disease.
Working conditions inside the mine were appalling. The miners had to crawl around in the hot, dark stopes.
What's a stope?
I'm guessing it's like a tunnel or something like that.
It is a step-like part of a mine where minerals are being extracted.
Okay.
So almost kind of like terrace-like, I would guess.
Right, yeah, okay. Yeah.
So they had to crawl around in the hot, dark stopes on their knees, gouging out the blue asbestos, which was in very thin bands in the hard rock.
Mm-hmm.
It was 20 years before company management even bothered to bore an air hole from the surface to the mine to supply the miners with fresh air.
Wow.
Oh, well, only 20 years.
I could hold my breath that long.
In a geological sense, that's blink of an eye, right?
It's true. It's true. Think of how long the asbestos has been in that mountain.
Precisely.
With no air holes.
Yeah, exactly. The asbestos is getting by without air holes just fine.
Won't somebody think of the asbestos? This is why it's so damaging to the lungs, because it gets in there and there's all that air, and it's
that's
like,
right.
Yay,
we
this
crave
air is mine!
Air.
Yeah.
The ore from the mine was then taken to the mill for processing via conveyor belt. Milling was a dry process where the ore was ground down and the fiber then extracted. Conditions were so bad that the men needed floodlights to see through the dust at midday.
Wow. They needed floodlights to see through the dust.
That's a lot of asbest dust.
Is that what they called it? Asbestos. The men worked in these clouds of asbestos dust for hours on end when only 1 minute at such concentrations to blue asbestos fibers would have been enough to cause lung cancer and mesothelioma.
You know what the ironic part about asbestos is?
Mesothelioma.
Asbestos has best right in the middle
That's
of it.
That's right. You
That's
can't
the
spell
irony.
Asbestos without best.
Best.
We've got the best asbestos.
That should have been their slogan if
bestest,
it wasn't.
Best, TM. Bestest,
I just TM'd that one.
Asbestos.
I don't know
bestest,
if I'll use
bestest,
it.
Asbestos. At Wittenoom, thousands of workers and their families, visitors, tourists, consultants, and government officials were exposed to lethal levels of blue asbestos, 1,000 times higher than occupationally regulated at the time. By 1986, there had been 85 deaths from pleural and peritoneal mesothelioma.
That is a mesothelioma.
That is an uncommon and malignant tumor of the mesothelium.
Which is the lining of the abdomen?
No, I think it's lung.
It's a membrane of flat cells that line the body cavity of embryos and forms the squamous cells of the peritoneum, pericardium, and pleura. So,
squamous.
Yeah, you're right.
I win! You lose!
Oh. Here you have a Star Wars candy.
Yeah, no, it says an uncommon malignant tumor of the mesothelium, usually of the lungs.
Yeah.
So I was right.
I guess we're both right. Although begrudgingly, I will admit that.
Just hug it out.
Hug it out, Hugosaurus. Mesothelioma incident rates increase exponentially with time since first exposure, and also increase with intensity to exposure to crocodolite.
I don't know if it's pronounced Croc-a-Delight.
It sounds it's like the a Croc-a-Delight.
It sounds like a snack cracker.
Groove is
like
in the lungs, yeah. Groove is in the lungs.
No, that's Croc-o-D-Light.
Yeah.
Mathematical modeling of the relationship between mesothelioma incidence and intensity of exposure, duration of exposure, and time since first exposure results in an estimate of up to 700 cases of mesothelioma by the year 2020 in this cohort.
Okay.
Do you know what a cohort is?
It's a Roman legion, isn't it? It's like something to do with Roman soldiers, I'm pretty sure.
That's the guys who hang out with a hort.
Yeah.
The cohort.
Yeah.
Here comes Hort and his cohorts. Hort and cohort here who.
It absolutely is the loss of Dr. Seuss book.
An accomplice, an associate in crime, or a group of people supporting the same thing or person?
Oh, a group of people.
You knew that, didn't you? I thought we were making a joke about a common word.
I've never heard cohort used in that fashion, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's an odd way to use it. But they're Australian, so what do they know?
Here's a statement from the government of Western Australia, which you can read on their website today.
Okay.
Mesothelioma and lung cancer can develop after brief exposure to asbestos. The time between exposure to asbestos and the occurrence of cancer can be 20 to 40 years or even longer. Blue asbestos, the type once mined in Wittenoom, is the most deadly of all types of asbestos. Remnants of blue asbestos are still present in Wittenoom, presenting a serious risk to your health. The fibres move by wind and water, and also by human activities. The asbestos mining operations in the Wittenoom area and the resulting remnants of asbestos have already resulted in hundreds of fatalities among miners, residents, and visitors to the town.
A little more Kiwi than Australian, wasn't it?
I like the fact that cancer doesn't sound nearly as bad in an Australian accent as it does.
Asbestos fibers are like tiny needles, which when inhaled migrate through the lung to a thin membrane called the pleura.
Mm-hmm.
Asbestos fibers are so thin and tiny that an amount which would cover a pin, if lined up end to end, would reach from the earth to the sun.
That is pretty tiny.
That's really
tiny. Wow. You said earth to the, and I thought you were going to say moon. Sun. Wow.
That's according to sarcoidosis.com.
Okay. Mm.
The mine struggled into profit for the 5 years from 1956, and then only by making its workforce work two and even three shifts a day. When the mine closed in
Isn't three shifts a day the entire day?
I don't know how long an asbestos mine shift is normally.
Maybe they can't put you down for 8 hours. Maybe a shift is 6 hours. That would be 18-hour days.
When the mine closed in 1966, it had accumulated a debt of around $2.5 million. Despite the loss of the mining operation, people stayed in Wittenoom. Mines went away, but they hung out.
That's the Darwin Award in effect.
Yeah.
That's the people, really stupid people, eliminating themselves from the gene pool.
You're living in a town, all the jobs go away, but maybe you're like, oh, we like it here. Well, our friends are here.
But all the jobs went away because everyone was dropping dead from lung disease. Like,
maybe all the doctors stayed.
And maybe everybody was too winded to pack up. I'd go,
In 1978, the government began the process of phasing down activity in the town. In the late 80s and early 90s, buildings were demolished, civil services closed, and the airport shut down.
Hey, why would you even bother demolishing the building? Like, why don't you just leave it fallow? Like, just let it be reclaimed.
If I can't have it, nobody can.
Yeah. It feels like it's like almost spiteful, right? Like, screw this town. Kabow.
Well, the government advised the residents they would not be forced to leave, but that new residents would not be encouraged to the town. Mm-hmm. And the government abandoned the idea of a cleanup at that point.
No, asbestos seems like one of those things that's harder to deal with after the fact than to create the problem.
I wouldn't worry about it. No good government in the world allows asbestos mining anymore.
Canada.
Oh, crap. Well, the great thing about our current government is they're not the government of Canada. They're the Harper government now.
That's right. Exactly.
So once they're gone, we'll be able to say, that wasn't Canada.
That was the Harper. That wasn't government of Canada. That was the Harper government. Yeah.
I love the fact that up until quite recently, that town in Quebec was actually named Asbestos Quebec.
Mm, yeah. Nice.
Right.
Then that kind of got a negative connotation for some reason.
And then it changed to mesothelioma. mesothelioma.
It started to hurt the tourist dollar for some reason.
In 2006, the government turned off the power grid. Today, the air remains contaminated and toxic to breathe if stirred. And the state of Western... So basically, if you move in it, probably. And the state of Western Australia has the highest rate of malignant mesothelioma per capita of anywhere in the world.
Woohoo!
We're number one. We're number one.
Well, although the population is only 8, so you probably only need one of them to have it in order to like be the per capita highest per capita rate in the world, right?
Well, it really does lend credence to my they're all too winded to leave. It's actually 8 of 8, and the reason that they haven't left is because they just don't have the strength.
This is a 100% occurrence, right? I'm not surprised because it couldn't get any higher.
The town's name was removed from official maps and roadsides in 2007.
Oh, snap! That's hard to take. When you actually get taken off the map.
Yeah.
There's just a big sign that says, here be dragons.
Asbestos dragons. Blue asbestos dragons.
Lung dragons.
They breathe very cold asbestos cones.
Now we gotta make modern day dragons. There's the blue asbestos dragon and the red radiation dragon.
Right. Yeah. That's Godzilla, isn't it?
And the black hole dragon. It breathes gravity waves.
Okay, sure.
I don't know.
I look forward to playing this role-playing game.
The yellow cake uranium dragon.
Yes.
And finally, the 1990 Midnight Oil song for a bit of pop culture, Blue Sky Mine. Sky Mining was inspired by the town and its mining industry.
Okay. Those guys were socially conscious.
Oh man.
a little too much.
Exclamation point
Their lead singer is a practicing lawyer.
Yeah.
And most of his jobs were representing the indigenous population in their land claims.
Yeah, and didn't he ran for political office or something at some point too in Australia. Like he's an activist.
Yeah.
Down, down, down. Moving on. Pitcher, Oklahoma. Founded 1913. Function? Zinc and lead mining town. Supplied bullets for U.S. soldiers fighting in World War I and II.
Oh, okay. Hmm.
Maximum population in 1946 was 15,000. Current population in 2011, 6 homes and 1 business. That business being Old Miner's Pharmacy.
Is it really?
Yeah.
So like, if you're going to have a town with only one business, would you think that business would be a pharmacy?
Yeah, well, because the pharmacy can do everything, right? Like, think of our Shopper's Drug Mart here, right?
I guess you'd have a place to get condoms.
A few groceries, condoms.
Post office.
The medicine you need. You can have the post office built right into there. Yeah.
Small town USA. There was always, like, the soda shop
general store slash pharmacy.
Yeah. Same sort of thing. Okay, I can buy that. Not a bordello, though?
Well, that'd be number 2.
Yeah, because when you see the, like, Wild Wild West, the bordello was the first thing that opened,
and you'd want that right next to the pharmacy for obvious reasons. Yes,
for the penicillin,
So the mining companies pulled out in the 1970s.
No need for bullets anymore? I don't buy that. Charlton Heston was kicking around.
At which point, acid water flooded the mines.
Acid water flooded the mines?
Yeah, well, water flooded the mines and became acidic.
Oh, okay. All right. No, it didn't just come in as acid. That would have been awesome.
Maybe a little bit of that.
Some sort of like evil villain plot, right?
A century of unrestricted underground excavation dangerously undermined most of the buildings, creating sinkholes.
Call back to our sinkholes episode.
And left giant piles of toxic, metal-contaminated mine tailings known as chat.
Chat.
Yeah.
C-H-A-T?
Correct. Heaped throughout the area. Chat piles left behind by the mining companies contain lead dust that is blown around the city.
Ooh, lead dust. That does not sound good.
Elevated lead levels in children have led to learning disabilities and other problems.
Mm, nice.
The lead and zinc have also seeped into groundwater, ponds, and lakes.
Oh, we know how well groundwater and lead goes. They're like, you know, that's like chocolate and peanut butter.
Mmm. Kids started coming home from swimming in ponds near the mines complaining of what they thought were sunburns, never realizing that the pools were full of caustic chemicals. The toxic chemicals eventually turned the waterways red.
So these townspeople are literally soda jerks.
In 2006, the Army Corps of Engineers study showed that 86% of Pitcher's buildings were badly undermined and subject to collapse at any time.
Mm.
The discovery of the cave-in risks groundwater contamination and health effects associated with the chat piles and subsurface shafts, particularly in an alarming 1996 study which showed lead poisoning in over a third of the children in Pitcher, eventually prompted a mandatory evacuation and buyout of the entire township by the EPA. And then, that's not enough.
That's not the end of the story? I thought we were just concluding. We're wrapping this one up.
In 2008, an F4 tornado came through town.
Oh, boy.
Oh, nice. Lead dust with an F4 tornado.
Do you guys remember how rates?
This is the plot
on the Fuji
to a sci-fi channel TV movie. This is what this is. An F4 tornado hits a place with, like, contamination lying all around.
It's going to pick up the contamination and become sentient.
It's going to be a sentient
evil tornado rampaging across America, killing.
Like a evil chaotic evil elemental.
Oh, yeah.
I have so TM'd
an air pollution elemental.
This is giving me so many ideas for my Mutilator Survivors in the Wasteland game.
Nice. Yeah, you're going to use all these dragons?
Yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. Totally.
So, yeah, do you guys remember what how F4 falls?
Well, F5 is the biggest, right? That, like, cracks the earth in half, right?
No, that's not true.
No,
sir.
That's not what happened? It, like, burrows all the way through to
the
center of the earth?
Yeah, there's only been, like, 3 F5s in history. We've been cracked, like, 3 times.
Yeah, and, totally.
We got better.
Uh-huh. It is devastating, quote unquote.
Okay.
Which is less than incredible, but more than severe.
This sounds like the old Marvel superheroes role-playing
exactly
game.
What I was thinking.
My character has amazing strength.
Do you remember how the ratings went in Marvel superheroes?
Amazing
briefly.
Was like
Unearthly was the highest.
Yeah.
Like you was Unearthly.
Actually, Shift X became the highest after Unearthly wasn't high enough.
Right. Yeah.
But it went excellent. Well, it went like normal, and then it went excellent. Remarkable, incredible, amazing, monstrous, and unearthly.
That's
unearthly,
right, monstrous. Yeah. That's when I first began. Yeah.
So anyway, tornado went through town.
Uh-huh.
Leveled buildings, flipped cars, debarked trees.
Those poor trees.
Much like
trees.
You would see in a cartoon.
Debarked the dogs.
And then the tree would like try to cover itself.
Yeah. Debarked the dogs because they were killed.
Sorry, Deanna. We had the dog debarked. And by that, I mean we had it put down. It destroyed or damaged 150 homes.
All right. Most of them were empty, so no problem.
June 29th, 2009, all of the residents had been given federal checks to enable them to relocate from Pitcher permanently.
Those layabouts taking government money. Yeah. Why don't they just suck it up and take their cancer a good citizen?
I'm sure Rush Limbaugh would have something to say about this, about these deadbeats living
Absolutely.
Off the government teat.
Yeah. The town is considered to be too toxic to be habitable. On the last day, the residents met at the school auditorium to say goodbye.
Bye.
Although a few people refused to leave.
Of course.
Again, this is natural selection at work right here, right now.
They call themselves chat rats.
Nice.
A loose and increasingly self-reliant colony armed with cell phones and Wi-Fi for communication and guns for driving off scrap metal scavengers. This is totally like post-apocalyptic wasteland.
It is.
Max right here.
It's like Homer Simpson guarding his sugar pile, though.
Yeah,
like,
pretty much.
You are guarding contaminated scrap metal. Stop it.
I think one of these guys has got a YouTube channel, The Pitcher Boy. PicherBoy.
Yeah, we can put a post up on the website too, causticsodapodcast.com.
I think it's mostly videos of them going around shooting at cans and stuff like that.
Really?
All right, next we have Oradour-sur-Glane.
Oradour-sur-Glane. That sounds like somewhere foreign.
It's in France, in fact.
Sur. Oh, on. Sur.
It's probably Oradour-sur-Glane.
Year founded? Couldn't find out.
Lost in antiquity. Perhaps.
Maybe. The function of the town? Couldn't find out.
Okay.
But so. I did find out the maximum population was about 650. The current population is zero.
Okay.
Early on the morning of 10th June 1944, a German battalion sealed off the town of Oradour-sur-Glane, having confused it with a nearby town suspected of harboring members of the French resistance.
Oh, that's not something you want to be mistaken for.
Yeah. They ordered all the townspeople and anyone who happened to be in or near the town to assemble in the village square, ostensibly to have their identity papers examined.
Okay.
In addition to the residents of the village, the SS also apprehended 6 people who did not live there but had the misfortune to be riding their bikes through the village when the Germans arrived.
Mm-hmm.
All of the women and children were locked in the church while the village was looted. Meanwhile, the men were led to 6 barns and sheds where machine gun nests were already in place. The soldiers began shooting at them, aiming for their legs so that they could die more slowly.
Oh, lovely.
Once the victims were no longer able to move, the soldiers covered their bodies with fuel and set the barns on fire.
Who makes that call and who agreed? Like, look, I was only following orders. I can kind of, you know, kill these people. Yes, sir. And then you kill them. I mean, I wouldn't do it, but you can kind of get it. Kill these people, but shoot them in the legs so they die more slowly.
And then cover their bodies in fuel and
set
them
on fire.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just going to shoot them in the head.
You know what I think I've learned here?
Yes.
The Nazis were assholes.
Yeah. Apparently they were the bad guys.
That's the take-home message. Hmm.
It's almost like bad in a comical sense. Like in that it's so over-the-top bad guy thing to do. It almost sounds like it's the plot of a really terrible war movie.
Right.
As opposed to something that actually happened in the war.
Yeah, you'd watch it and you'd be like, come on, the Nazis were evil, but there's no way that they would shoot people in the leg so that they would die more slowly. Come
on.
And
then set them on fire.
Yeah.
Only six men escaped. One of them was later seen walking down a road heading for the cemetery and was shot dead.
Heading for the cemetery. A little foreshadowing,
yeah, maybe.
Perhaps.
In all, 190 men perished. The soldiers then proceeded to the church and placed an incendiary device there. After it was ignited, women and children tried to escape through the doors and windows of the church. They were met with machine gun fire.
Lovely.
A total of 247 women and 205 children died in the carnage. That night, the village was partially razed. No less.
Oh,
than...
they lifted it up off the ground?
Yeah.
But
not very far. Powers. Villages are heavy.
Yeah.
So it's like...
They just put everything up on cinder blocks.
Well, you know, to take the tires off, right? So they could get to the... Yeah.
They started with the cars and said, this is a good look. Let's do it to all the buildings, too.
That's right. They do all the cars. This isn't symmetrical.
Now it doesn't work.
Got to lift up the buildings, too.
That German completism kind of worked against him on this one.
So no less than 642 inhabitants of Oradour-sur-Glan had been murdered in a matter of hours. And war criminal Heinz Barth, now you know his name, admitted at his trial there was no military objective.
Do you think it's on purpose that it rhymed with Darth?
Barth Vader?
Yeah.
Wasn't that one of the characters? And no, you can't do that on television?
That was the original
name. I heard that. After the war, a new village of Oradour-sur-Glan was built nearby. The original was left alone to remain a memorial to the cruelty of the Nazi occupation. In 1999, the French president dedicated a memorial museum, the Centre de la Mémoire d'Oradour, near the entrance to the martyred village.
See, like now that. Do we feel bad about making fun of the French?
No. Yeah.
Still don't. I would have felt bad about making fun of those French.
There were a lot of brave French freedom fighters.
There were indeed.
Times Beach, Missouri. Year founded, 1926.
Okay.
Function, initially a summer resort, then during the Depression, a low-income housing town.
Summer resort
That
became a low-income housing town. Those seem at odds with one another.
Well, when nobody's got money to go to a resort.
Then you lower the prices.
What state is this in?
Missouri.
Hey, let's go to a resort. Where do you want to go? Missouri.
Maximum population, 2240. That's 2,240.
Okay.
Current population, zero.
Uh-huh.
In 1971, plagued with dust problems due to its 23 miles of dirt roads and lack of pavement funds, the city hired waste hauler Russell Bliss to oil the roads in and around the town.
Mm-hmm.
For 4 years... Bliss sprayed waste oil on the roads at low cost.
They used to do this back when I was younger on some of the dirt roads in Chilliwack.
They do it in Saskatchewan on some of the dirt roads between farms.
When a spraying resulted in the death of 62 horses, the owners of the stable suspected Bliss, who assured them it was just used engine oil. However, Bliss
Hold on. There's going to be a big reveal here.
However, Bliss, who had taken a contract with a local company called ICP to dispose of toxic waste from the Northeastern Pharmaceutical and Chemical Company.
You cannot trust the insane clown posse with chemicals. They don't understand science.
It was the makeup from the insane clown posse. When they wipe all it off after every show... Collect it in bins and give it and sell it as.
We are talking about a band that thinks that magnets are magic.
ICP. Yes, yeah, so the Northeastern Pharmaceutical and Chemical Company, NAPACO.
NAPACO.
Acronymized.
Sounds harmless enough.
Rhymes with tobacco. NAPACO produced the disinfectant hexachlorophene. Hexachlorophene products can be lethal if absorbed through the skin.
I don't like anything that either starts with hexo or contains chloro.
Yeah, there's not much good chloro. Yeah. Chlorophyll in the plants, but that's about it.
Uh-huh. Don't be a
chloroform.
Don't be a chloroform.
But then you hexa it and it's... Yeah.
Also, some parts of NAPACO's facility had been used for the production of Agent Orange during the Vietnam War.
Oh, so they got a track record.
And the waste, clay, and water contained levels of dioxin some 2,000 times higher than the dioxin content in Agent Orange.
2,000 times higher than Agent Orange.
Correct. Bliss had mixed his waste oil with NAPACO waste.
Why? Like, why? Why? Why would you do that? I don't understand what he was thinking. Oh, well, you know what? A population was down, so he probably didn't have enough engine oil. It was like the filler. It was like the, cellulose in his Taco Time taco.
Well, the population didn't go down until after all this stuff happened.
Oh, okay.
In 1982, stories began to appear about the discovery of dioxin in Times Beach. Tests showed dioxin levels 100 times higher than the amount generally considered to be hazardous to humans. On December 5th, 1982, the local river flooded, causing an evacuation as more than 95% of the city was covered with 10 feet or more of water.
Oh.
10 feet or more of water, which would move around all this lovely dioxin.
Nice.
Oh, man.
On December 23rd, 1982, the EPA announced that it identified dangerous levels of dioxin in Times Beach's soil. Panic spread through the town, with many illnesses, miscarriages, and animal deaths attributed to the dioxin. 2 months later, the EPA announced the town's buyout for $32 million. PCBs were also found in Times Beach soil.
Okay.
By 1985, the town was evacuated except for one elderly couple who refused to leave, and the site was quarantined.
Why, I'm not going anywhere, you whippersnapper.
I've been here all my life. I'm not going anywhere.
It's like the grandfather in Little Miss Sunshine.
Oh, yeah.
Close to death anyway. Yeah. Why bother moving?
Nope, this town is mine now. You left it on my front yard. It's mine now.
Residents were shunned in their new communities by people who feared the effects of exposure to dioxin was contagious. So that's
nice.
A little bonus.
Nice.
Today, the land that was once Times Beach is now Route 66 State Park. One building from the town still exists. The park's visitor center was once a roadhouse from Times Beach's glory days and was the EPA's headquarters for the area. There is a large grass mound beneath which is the debris of the demolished buildings of the former town.
So wow. The guy who actually
beautiful
spread,
Times Beach.
Well, the guy who actually spread all this stuff around, did say anything there about some repercussions? Like, did he go to jail or
many
get
of the
fined,
town's
or?
Citizens sued Bliss, NAPACO, and its various subcontractors. Although the ethics and legality of Bliss's practices have been questioned, Bliss was never convicted.
I mean, you can't really hold NAPACO responsible unless you can prove that they knew what he was going to do with it, right? Like, there's a waste disposal guy who says, I'm going to take your waste off your hands, and you pay me X number of dollars, and I will dispose of it. And they go, all right, okay, sign the contract, here you go. And then the fact that he goes and sprays it on roads for like 8 years or six over like a 6 year span.
And gets away with it. He's like the fifth horseman of the apocalypse, hazardous waste. He's not a human. He's this like evil entity who appears human and is just like, I'll oil these dirt roads for you. No problem. Mix, 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 spray.
Why?
Just the one that needed something to cut the oil with. What am I going to do with all this toxic waste?
Well, he didn't know, right?
I got it all piled up in barrels behind my shack.
Yeah.
Got to get rid of it. I'll just.
You should have just buried them in the groundwater.
What could possibly go wrong?
It's also like Homer Simpson. Like Homer would do this.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could see Homer. Hey, let's just put some of this toxic waste in here.
If Hollywood has taught me anything,
yes, Kevin,
this town should have turned into a town of superheroes.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So something obviously went wrong. The fact that they adulterated the toxic waste with oil.
Or mutants. If not
them,
superpowers, just mutants.
Yeah. They kept
maybe
them
it
from
did.
Becoming the
maybe
comic
it did,
book.
And the government's keeping it hush-hush.
Ah, I see. That's another comic book.
TM!
Each ghost town is a birth of a new member of the Freedom Force.
Yeah.
However, since that town, they have never been able to get the combination of oil and PCDs, Agent Orange exactly right.
Exactly. They keep trying and
to make the super soldier.
Caustic soda.
They just keep dying.
Caustic soda listeners, feel free to experiment at home.
Oh, no. Do not do that.
They're accidentally making evil monsters now. So that's good because now the heroes have
somebody
to fight.
It's all self-contained.
It's the circle of life.
You create the one super soldier that's crazy, and then you create the super soldier that's good, and then you create the minor super soldiers who he has to fight.
Makes perfect sense.
I'm in. I will watch that movie and or read that comic book.
Marvel was prophetic, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
All right, last one. Centralia, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Year founded, 1841.
Ooh, so an actual old town.
Yeah. Function, coal mining.
Okay.
Most of the mining companies went out of business in the 60s, though bootleg mining continued until 1982.
Bootleg mining. What, like they would secretly mine without permission?
I think so.
How can you secretly mine coal? Like it's not like you can get out there with a
Don't let them know we're mining coal.
Exactly. Like it's not like they're taking out in wheelbarrows and sticking it like in the trunks of their cars.
No, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. Tink, 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 tink.
Like little jewelers' hammers, right? You're like,
Flourish, do you hear that?
People sleeping
tink,
next door.
Tink, tink. It's them bootleg miners again.
Maybe.
Give them a shotgun.
Maybe they're called bootleg miners because they put the coal in their boots. So that's how they got it out of there.
It's like Shawshank Redemption. He's walking out and walking the coal out in the yard and dropping it out of his pocket.
Yeah, there you go.
Maximum population, more than 2,000. Current population, zero.
Okay. They finally cracked down on the secret mining?
In 1962, the town council hired members of the Volunteer Fire Company for the annual town landfill cleanup. The landfill was located in an abandoned strip mine pit next to the cemetery.
Okay.
The firefighters, as they had in the past, set the dump on fire and let it burn for some time. Unlike in previous years, however, the fire was not extinguished correctly. The fire penetrated the vein of coal underneath the pit and lit a subterranean fire.
Oh, snap. And these are the firefighters who did this.
Volunteer firefighters.
Okay, all right. Volunteer firefighters in a town of 2,000 people. Yeah. They probably didn't graduate at the top of the firefighting class.
The fire spread through a hole in the rock pit into the abandoned mines beneath Centralia. Attempts to extinguish the fire were unsuccessful. In the early years of the fire, Centralians enjoyed not having to shovel their sidewalks and being able to harvest tomatoes from the warm ground in midwinter. Those were the halcyon days, my friends.
So the ground of the town was literally warm to the touch.
Probably in places.
Yeah. It's like having that, like, your in-floor heating in your house like an entire town.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you don't have to get out of bed and worry about the cold tiles on your feet and whatever.
And all it costs you is whatever happens when coal burns the ground.
I think we're about to find out what that might be.
But then,
as
the ground below burned to ash, the pavement started to buckle.
And how long did this take? This happened over days? Are we talking months? Are we talking years?
Oh, let me get to that.
Okay.
The trees started dying. People started passing out in their homes from toxic fumes. Centralia's moment of clarity came in 1981.
This started in the 60s. Started in the 60s.
Yeah, so it was burning for 20 years.
That is a slow burn.
It was a slow burn.
There were adults who were born as the fire started.
Yes. Centralia's moment of clarity came in 1981 when the ground beneath 12-year-old Todd Domboski opened up. Todd, who had been cutting through a resident's yard, saved himself from plunging into the toxic inferno below by clinging to a tree root until a cousin rescued him.
Okay, Toxic Inferno is totally another title for a sci-fi TV movie.
The mine fire was dramatically described in the book Unseen Danger, A Tragedy of People, Government, and the Centralia Mine Fire. This was a world where no human could live. Hotter than the planet Mercury. Its atmosphere is poisonous to Saturn's. At the heart of the fire, temperatures easily exceeded 1,000 degrees. Lethal clouds of carbon monoxide and other gases swirled through the rock chambers.
This guy wanted to be an astronomer. He was a frustrated astronomer. All these references to things that happen in space.
The fire underlies 1.6 square kilometers under the town and may continue to burn for the next 250 years.
That is awesome.
Poisonous gas rises from fissures in the pavement.
Wow.
Here's a quick timeline.
We've got some video of this too, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll put a link to this video up on the website, causticsodapodcast.com, if you want to go and check out toxic fumes emanating from the ground in Centralia, Pennsylvania.
So the government allocated money for relocation. Most of the residents accepted buyout offers and moved to nearby communities. In 2002, the Postal Service revoked Centralia's zip code. Revoked. And in 2009, Governor Ed Rendell began the formal eviction of Centralia residents. Today, very few homes remain standing in Centralia. Most of the abandoned buildings have been demolished by humans or nature.
Yeah, or collapsed into the ground and sucked into the toxic inferno.
At a casual glance, the area now appears to be a field with many paved streets running through it. Some areas are being filled with new growth forest. It is expected that many former residents will return in 2016 to open a time capsule buried in 1966 next to the Veterans Memorial, if they can find it.
Assuming that it hasn't been consumed by flame, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This is, I mean, the great part about this one is it's totally...
Oh, the phonograph records are all charred.
It's a totally they-did-it-to-themselves moment. It's not like it was Mother Nature or anything
like
this.
It's those volunteer firefighters, I tell you.
Well, I guess Mother Nature did put the coal there for it to get caught on fire.
Yeah.
Bad,
dirty
years.
Mother Nature. It's just like a time bomb waiting to go off. Yeah. It's true of Mother Nature at all times.
Goodbye now. Goodbye now. I thought the party was divine. I spent the evening forgetting the time. I can't deny, but now goodbye. Goodbye now, goodbye now. The trip by taxi wasn't far. We'd linger longer if we had a car. No use to cry, and now goodbye. There's one advantage to our leaving. It brings about a special kiss. I hope that this will be eternally a momentary parting, just a second, then we're starting. So goodbye now, goodbye now. It's just a moment we're apart. To make it certain, I'll leave you my heart. But for now, goodbye now. There are many, many ways to say goodbye. How do you say adieu? In the movies, they linger on a kiss. When you're married, it's easily dismissed. On the campus, they've a different little twist. But this is how I like to say goodnight. Goodbye now. Goodbye now. I thought the party was divine. I spent the evening forgetting the time. I can't deny, but now goodbye. Goodbye now. Goodbye now.
In the news. February 2012. Residents of a central Pennsylvania coal town decimated by a half-century-old mine fire.
Oh, wait, hold on, hold on. It's, nope, I lost it. I don't know what this is.
Have lost a state court appeal to try to prevent condemnation of their land, but the long-running case will continue in federal court.
There are some former residents of Centralia who have been thrown out of the town who are trying to get their land back.
The Commonwealth Court rejected arguments by seven Centralia property owners who say condemnation is no longer needed because the underground fire has moved and air quality in the borough has improved.
Oh, so they're trying to get our land is all burnt out exemption.
I guess so.
Right.
The court upheld a 2010 ruling that set fair market value for the properties that the Commonwealth began contemning in 1993. Mm-hmm. The property owners, however, have also lodged a civil rights complaint against the state and other defendants alleging a conspiracy to steal the mineral rights to billions of dollars worth of anthracite coal.
Didn't it all burn, though?
Well, it's going to burn for the next 200 years, so maybe they can get those mineral rights and put it out and get that coal off of themselves.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mine, mine!
The suit names the State Department of Community and Economic Development, a law firm, a coal company, and the County Redevelopment Authority. A federal judge last year refused to issue an injunction that would have stopped the condemnation. More than 1,000 residents left and more than 500 homes were knocked down in the relocation program that was largely completed by 1993 when officials invoked eminent domain, which is basically legally condemning property. Only a handful remain in Centralia, resisting the state's efforts to get them to leave.
In the government's defense, justifiably so, their land is on fire.
Yes,
and
yes,
noxious
it is.
Fumes are leaking out
but
of the ground.
But it's our burning land.
Yeah.
I was born in this burning land. I was raised in this burning land.
The government can't tell me to get off my burning land full of toxic fumes.
The land is burning.
Back to Midnight Oil.
I know. I'm full circle on that one. Honestly, if my land was on fire and somebody was going to give me money for it, I'd be happy to let it go.
That's because you're not a crackpot. You're not a crackpot holdout.
I'm sitting there going, okay, I can move back into my house.
I had my first kiss on this burning land.
And get... It was very romantic. We had that glow, right, coming from the earth,
glow.
Right? Steamy glow. It was like in a movie. And we were both, like, really high from the fumes, so it seemed outrageously good.
Yeah, maybe that's it. They're addicted to the carbon monoxide high that they're on constantly.
I have an article from Time magazine about an upcoming ghost town, or maybe even ghost city.
Yeah.
Detroit. Apparently,
Detroit Motor City?
Detroit Motor City, Detroit, Michigan. back in the 50s and 60s, Detroit, Michigan was once America's fourth largest city.
That's big. Okay.
1.8 million residents.
Only three bigger.
That's what fourth means. Right now, it is the 13th largest and has half the population it had in the 50s. It has about 900,000 people, less than a million.
Dwindling.
But so, the population of America has gone up overall, has it not?
By leaps and bounds, yeah, absolutely. By any quantifiable standard, the city is on life support. Detroit's treasury is $300 million short of the funds needed to provide the barest municipal services. The school system, which 6 years ago was compelled by the teachers' union to reject a philanthropist's offer of $200 million, to build 15 small independent charter high schools, is in receivership. The murder rate is soaring and 7 out of 10 remain unsolved. The police basically have given up.
Why is there so much murder?
Look at the crime, right? I mean, it's just, you know, everybody's just, you know.
Just lawlessness, general lawlessness.
Yeah. Basically, all the people who agree with being nice to each other in society.
They've moved on.
They've left. Right. They're like, yeah,
they're
this is not good.
So,
and everybody left is just desperate. They're desperate. They're not happy. They're angry
Don't
at each
you
other.
Mean desperate.
Desperate. 3 years ago, 3 years after Katrina devastated New Orleans, unemployment there was 11%, which was staggering.
Yeah.
In Detroit, the unemployment rate is 28.9%. Out of all the postal addresses in Detroit right now, 20% are unoccupied. One out of every five buildings. And I have another article which has a map of Detroit showing the different boroughs. And in some of them, the unoccupied rate is 50% or higher. And that's specifically down in the downtown core.
Yeah, this is the weird part, is that it's the downtown core that is depopulated,
right?
You can't even just like kind of shut down the extremities and sort of like move everything into the center.
Going the other way.
It's going the opposite direction.
They tied so much of their prosperity into
manufacturing.
The manufacturing, specifically the automobile manufacturing. Yeah. And they made all their factories.
People aren't buying cars anymore?
Well, what happened was they weren't paying attention to the trends in automobile creation. This article mentions that in the 70s, the auto workers union recognized what was going on with car manufacturing and that people were going to want cheaper,
smaller,
more efficient, smaller cars that you know, the everyday American could afford.
Toyotas and Hondas, basically.
They offered a deal to the auto manufacturing companies. If you start making these kinds of cars, our workers will work for less because this will mean that you're going to last longer.
Interesting.
And they rejected the offer and continued to make big, gas-guzzling, expensive vehicles. And then, of course, were crushed by the Japanese.
Yeah.
Who makes all those SUVs now?
But here's what happened. Foreign ownership started coming in because these American car companies stopped doing well. And as soon as foreign ownership came in, there was no reason to stick around in Detroit, where they had also built up some of the highest wages for manufacturing jobs in North America.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, like with all the benefits and stuff like that, like, you know, because it's a really old industry, you know, and you give people like sort of little incremental raises every couple of years and blah, blah, blah. With all the benefits and everything accrued to your sort of like a generic line worker, they were making like $98 an hour or something like that.
Yeah, really, really high wages, which at the back in the heyday was fair because the companies were making so much money
that
it was worth it to pay your employees well.
Yeah.
But then as soon as this competition came in, just everybody suffered.
Yeah.
Because of that, all these highly trained people were all only highly trained to make vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all expecting high wages. And the companies, now being owned more and more by foreign investors, said, yeah, it's not worth it to work here anymore, pulled out, and then the city had nothing left for the people to do.
All right, then.
And so what happened was all the businesses, which is in the downtown core, just don't have anybody supporting them, so they leave.
And it becomes like a snowball effect, too, right?
Exactly.
Because everybody loses their jobs, so no one goes to a restaurant, no one goes to the bar, no one goes to the corner store, no one goes to the pharmacy, and all that stuff goes out of business, too, and it just becomes this like tumbling.
And then they leave, and then they leave.
And all you got left is murder. As a recreation.
Yeah, no, as well as your industry, your homegrown murder industry. Yeah.
The grassroots murder.
How does that pay?
CERN.
Well, you can't really export it is what the problem is.
I do remember hearing something about a website called ForgottenDetroit.com where you can see pictures and blog posts and whatnot about what's going on there.
I have some really great images also from Time.com. My favorite, and I think I'm going to put this one picture on our site and I'll link to the rest. It's the United Artists Theater, which is this Spanish Gothic theater built in 1928, was closed in the 1970s. And it is like out of like a Tim Burton movie.
Yeah, it's spectacular.
This dilapidated, beautiful Gothic theater. and it's just falling apart and looks so amazing. You would expect to see some kind of Batman villain living.
We'll see yeah. that in all the theaters around town, though, because of internet piracy and whatnot.
Yeah.
In just a couple years. December 2011, Ordos in Inner Mongolia is one of the wealthiest regions in China, mainly due to vast reserves of coal and natural gas.
Okay.
In its obsessive pursuit of GDP, the new Kangbashi district in Ordos was planned and built in just 5 years with an eye on the future development, with massive investments to the tune of several billion dollars on building and infrastructure.
Billions of dollars. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. There's only one small problem.
Okay.
The city, intended for 1 million residents and filled with all the amenities that signal a prosperous and modern boomtown, has only one thing missing in it.
People.
Correct, sir.
So why? What happened? Why?
Famously dubbed China's empty city, the town of Ordos has become the favorite example of those convinced that China is in the midst of a runaway property bubble, unmoored from reality.
Okay, so they built this entire city to service the industry, the gas and coal industry, hoping that they were probably intending on displacing all yeah. these people and putting them in this town. So what happened? Why? I mean, the Chinese government, they don't really make any bones about, you know, moving people where they don't necessarily want to go at any given point in time.
Well, the main reason why Kangbashi is empty seems to be a planning issue. The new town is 25 kilometers from the old town, which has discouraged people from moving. Though a government official may work in the new town, the family may have little reason to move there. With
right.
few residents, supporting services like restaurants can't survive in the new town, which is a further reason not to move there. It's kind of like, and this is slowly changing, but after right. the Olympics in Vancouver,
mm-hmm.
I moved close to the Olympic Village.
Right.
It was basically a ghost town for like a couple years.
Yeah, there's
like,
still
people are now starting to move in slowly.
The Olympic Village, up until like 3 months ago, or like right before Christmas, I saw a news story where it was still like 25-30% unoccupied.
Yeah. The bank is right on my way to work, and I would go in there. I'd be the only one in there just to go to the bank machine, and all the clerks would go like, "Hi, how you doing? Welcome." I was like overly happy to see people. It's so sad.
That's really strange, because the Chinese government, like, they do plan communities all the time. They just, like, I guess they just drop the ball on
yeah,
this
maybe.
One, right?
In empty showrooms in Dongsheng, Ordos's old city, salespeople immediately offer 30% price discounts if a buyer is willing to pay for a property up front and in cash. So it's like, it's almost like a pre-ghosty town.
Yeah, like it never was a town.
Yeah,
point
exactly.
Point of order, if you never lived, you can't be a ghost.
I guess that's true.
I guess that's true.
This is a stillbirth town.
Oh, yeah, nice.
An abortion town.
Pop culture?
I actually totally inadvertently saw a movie, perfect movie to watch for this topic.
What was it?
It was called The Claim.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's from around 2000 or 2001, something
like that. Is it a Western?
It is. It's set in the Old West. And the plot of the movie actually is, and I'm not giving that much away because it's sort of like this happens kind of about the first third of the movie. The main character, wealthy, he owns this town. He owns all the saloon and the brothel and everything, and it's his town. And how he came to own this town was he traded his wife and daughter to a prospector who was living there because he had this very rich claim. But he said, "I have all the gold in the world, but I don't want gold. I want a family." So they swapped the gold mine for the family, and this guy became really, like, rich and prosperous. And the movie starts.
It's almost like Treasure of the Sierra Madre meets, what's that other movie?
The Indecent Proposal.
Indecent Proposal.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sort of kind of is kind of like that, actually. So the movie begins when the wife and the daughter come back to town, like, 20 years later, because her new husband had died, she was now a widow, and
right.
she came to find him because she was dying from tuberculosis. Call back to our tuberculosis episode.
Oh, nice.
And quackery, because they tried all sorts of things to cure her.
Sure,
so
yeah.
It's like there's all sorts of caustic soda moments in this movie.
All right.
She comes back to bring the daughter so that he can take care of their daughter
okay.
once she dies.
Okay.
But he doesn't want his daughter to know that he sold them. Like, he feels
right.
really quite guilty about it,
yeah.
reasonably so. The B-plot storyline is the railroad man is in town, basically laying the groundwork for where the railroad's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all these frontier towns that want the railroad to go right through this
town. Yeah.
So this guy is trying to, like, bribe him with, like, prostitutes and money and booze and all the rest of this stuff to get him to put a train station in his town. And the guy falls in love with his daughter while he's there. But he decides ultimately that he's going to put the train station in a more logical place. Like it, they would have to kind of, you know,
love doesn't conquer all.
Love does not conquer all.
Doesn't conquer the railroad.
Yeah. And so the town is destined, doomed to become a ghost town. Quite a good movie.
Is anyone famous in it?
Mila Jovovich plays the main character's consort. He leaves her to go back with his original wife.
Well, who wouldn't? I mean, she's an ugly, ugly woman.
Yeah, and his original wife is played by Natasha Kinski.
Huh. Also, and, just...
yeah, I know. This guy's got it really rough. These are his two options, right? Sarah Pauly, good Canadian girl, plays the daughter. The guy who plays the drug dealer in Trainspotting, the Scottish guy, he plays the main character. It's kind of a slow-moving plot, and it's a character-driven piece,
mm-hmm.
and it's period, like set in the frontier West. But you know, I got a soft spot for those movies.
Well, that leads me to Winds of the Wasteland, a 1936 black and white John Wayne vehicle.
I've never been a fan of John Wayne. I do not have a soft spot.
Well,
for John
Wayne. It's 1936, so he's quite young. If he's, John Wayne can ever be young.
Just seeing him on camera and hearing his voice is like nails on the chalkboard to me. It's the only one who's more annoying on camera than him is Woody Allen.
He's still kind of that. He's still kind of got this, the, you know, the John Wayne swagger and, you know, you can't.
Hey there, pilgrim.
He doesn't say pilgrim.
He says something, though.
But
he's
unfazed.
He says, hey there, champ. Or
That was a little Yogi Bear mixed in. Hey there, pilgrim.
That's what he sounds
there,
like. Pilgrim. That's
what you got
like
in
me.
That picnic
Get
basket?
Get your hands out of that holster.
That's what he sounds like to me.
In the year 1861, John Blair, played by John Wayne, and his partner Larry Adams, Lane Chandler, are former Pony Express riders. They decide to start a stagecoach business and get tricked by the local coach magnate Cal Drake into a bum franchise in the ghost town Crescent City, population 2.
Hmm.
The mayor tells...
So is it a comedy?
No.
Does he get ripped off and seek revenge?
Yeah. No, it's none of those, really. The mayor tells the guys about a coach race arranged by the government, the winner of which will win a $25,000 mail delivery contract.
Ooh, and that's big money back in 1861.
Big money now. Wayne also saves a telegraph crew from drinking out of a poisoned water hole, and the boss of the crew agrees to run the telegraph through Crescent City.
Oh, so this is kind of like the opposite of the claim. They turn a ghost town into a prosperous town.
Yeah, exactly. Drake, upset that Blair is actually a competing business, decides to hire Blair to drive a gold shipment to Sacramento, only to ambush him. Blair escapes the ambush, collects the money at gunpoint. Drake also has his drivers try to sabotage John Wayne's character before and during the coach race.
Okay, so is this movie any good?
Oh, yes. That
pregnant pause that does not bode well for your review, but
it is
go
any
on.
Good. There is some good in it.
John Wayne movies
if
drive
you,
me nuts.
If you can watch, it was only an hour long.
The movie's only an hour?
Yeah.
How
and it's
weird.
So if you can watch
like back
really
in
crappy 1936 black and white production quality and whatnot. And like we were talking about before, this is set up very like
all stagey.
Right. In many ways. Like he'll get off a horse and say, well, here we are. You know, it's almost like a radio play kind of a thing.
And the whole like enter stage right and exit stage left. Like every John Wayne movie I've ever seen is kind of set up like that. Like all the directors aren't very cinematic, right? Especially his early stuff.
The characters, you know, there's a lot of kind of funny old West archetypes there. The mayor is like an old codger in town who will constantly putting on different hats because he's like one of only two people in the town.
Oh, the classic. Yeah. It kind of sounds like it's pseudo-comedy.
It's kind of comedy that's got some comedic moments, but it's mostly kind of like, you know, drama-ish.
One of my favorite movies of all time is actually kind of set in a ghost town. Kind of.
Okay.
Very much a Detroit-type ghost town.
Okay.
Blade Runner.
Oh.
Because remember, it's just him in that one huge building. And then when you also see...
The guy who has all the little robots.
All the little robots.
Like
he's basically the only man in a huge skyrise, right? He goes up all by himself.
Yeah.
It's all empty. He's got all this room to himself. Because I guess everybody's going to the off-world colonies.
Yeah.
Well, I've read the book, right, that it's based on...
Which is quite different.
Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, right? It's very interesting because it's very explicit in the book that Earth is basically depopulated. Like, he points out that...
It's a ghost planet.
He lived in a complex that used to house like 50,000 people or something, and he's there all alone. And he makes explicit mention of it. Mm-hmm. And Ridley Scott kind of alludes to it through the visuals, but doesn't mention it. And it's really weird when they're in the crowd scenes that there are these like massive bustling crowd scenes,
mm-hmm.
And then, but like you quite correctly point out, they kind of establish it, when they're in the living situations, that the planet is depopulated. And
yeah, there's really, probably like a bustling little downtown core where everybody agrees, let's all go here. This is where all the restaurants and stuff will be.
Yeah.
And we'll get the noodles. So everybody goes there, but then they all go back to where they're from, which is everybody's got their own sky rise.
I wonder if that makes his job of hunting down someone easier or harder.
Yeah, exactly.
There'd be less crowds to have to shoot through.
Yeah.
But so much more space.
Yeah, you know, I just found it interesting after reading the book that he didn't make it as explicit in the movie as it is in the book, right? That he doesn't point it out. He just kind of like left it out
I don't think
there.
It's important as important to the plot, though.
No, it's not important to the plot, but I found that interesting, right? Okay. Because when you sit there and think about it, you're like, oh, yeah, it totally is a depopulated planet. But when I first saw it, like I saw Blade Runner probably 5 times before I read the book.
Yeah.
And it never occurred to me that it was a depopulated planet. I was so much more interested in the progression of the plot and whether or not Deckard was an actual android. And all
the rest of robots fighting and shit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, I mean, Rutger Hauer was outstanding.
Tears in the rain. Also ghost planety would be WALL-E.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, 700 years in the future, mankind has abandoned Earth because it has become covered with trash from products sold by the mega corporation by and large. Left to clean up the mess is WALL-E and his pet cockroach. One day, Eve, a sleek and dangerous reconnaissance robot, is sent to Earth to find proof that life can exist there. WALL-E rescues Eve from a dust storm. He basically falls in love with her. Everyone's seen this movie.
It is charming. I mean, Pixar are masters of storytelling. That you can take a movie where the first half of the movie basically has no dialogue.
Yeah.
And in fact, WALL-E and Eve are robots. So creating expression.
You get more characterization and emotion from these robots in this
that
film.
That never speak.
Than tons of other movies with people in it.
I know. They are absolute masters of storytelling.
Within the first 5 minutes, there is a monologue via the holographic billboards. The first dialogue between WALL-E and Eve begins 22 minutes in the movie.
Yeah.
The first human dialogue appears 39 minutes into the movie.
That's just where you know that you got masters of the craft as opposed to, you know, all the pretenders out there.
I like WALL-E and Eve as a comparison of Mac versus PC, or rather PC versus Mac, where WALL-E is the PC and Eve is the Mac. And on the one hand, WALL-E's all crummy looking and stuff, and Eve is sleek and dangerous. But WALL-E functioned autonomously for 800 years, and Eve got locked down remotely and has no replacement parts. It's not my joke. I'd like to thank 4chan for that.
Do you guys know what WALL-E stands for?
Something autonomous load lifter?
Close.
Yeah, I've got no idea.
Waste allocation load lifter Earth class.
That's right.
The God load lifter. I like that. I remember Nicely done.
Starring Fred Willard as president of By and Large.
Yeah. Yes. The only, is there one or two other humans? But there's.
Only human. Contemporary humans are computer generated cartoons, but their ancestors, such as By and Large President Shelby Forthright and the actors in the Axiom ad, are all played by live actors.
Yeah, Ratzenberger had to have a part in there somewhere, right? He's been in every Pixar movie.
He's one of the humans on the on the cruise ship.
Yeah.
After hiring Fred Willard to play Forthright, the filmmakers made this an intentional stylistic choice to show that humans have greatly changed during 700 years in space.
The fat bastards who have to go around on their floaty chairs, right?
You know, Fred Willard is somebody's uncle. And how cool would it be to be that person?
Have Fred Willard as your uncle?
Because Fred Willard is like...
Uncle Fred?
The uncle.
He really is.
Yeah.
He's like the kind of smart ass.
He would introduce himself and say, pull my finger. Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Like, totally.
You know what would be the problem dealing with him, I think, outside of a filmmaking scenario?
Yeah.
You would never know when he was joking and when he wasn't. You'd have no idea. You're like, he is either hilarious or insane or both.
You guys haven't seen Silent Hill, have you?
I haven't seen
it. Or played the video game.
Well, the movie, the 2006 film, starring Radha Mitchell and Sean Bean.
My brother Mike, our sound engineer and general producer type, he liked it.
I wouldn't say I liked it, but it looked really cool.
Right.
In the film, the town of Silent Hill has been abandoned due to a prolonged mine fire, which was inspired by Centralia.
Oh, there you go.
Aspects of this are shown throughout the movie, such as characters wandering through the misty version of Silent Hill wearing mining gear.
I mentioned the fact that the first kiss, it would have been just like in a movie with all the mist and all the glowing and all the rest of that stuff.
Filmed in Brantford, Ontario, the decaying downtown strip that was used for most of the film is a section of Colburn Street, picked because that area of downtown is already in a state of decay and consisted mostly of abandoned buildings that could be easily dressed for filming.
How awesome is it that the name of the street is Coalburn?
Oh,
there's some synchronicity.
The story basically is a woman goes in search for her daughter within the confines of a strange, desolate town called Silent Hill, based on the video game.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a crazy cult and the coal fire, obviously. It's basically a ghost town with a crazy cult in it.
And Pyramid
Kid
Head.
Having daughters.
Yeah, and they basically go into another dimension and weirdness happens.
There's some sort of demonic thing going on.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it, but many of my friends are big fans of the video games and are really excited about them.
In the original script, there were only female characters. After submitting this, the script was returned to director Christopher Gans with a memo saying, there are no men.
So
he added Sean Bean.
So they added one? Oh, that's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, think of how many movies don't have women in them.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, so let's have one with no men.
As somebody who is in the film industry who has tried on, still actively trying on several occasions to get my own original content out there, and I've either written or considered casting with the female lead in mind. Every distributor wants you to ideally have a name actor that they can put on the poster and sell the movie based on, right? Because most people go to see movies to see the actors that are in them, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And buyers and distributors have told me repeatedly that you will not get as good a sales number if your lead is a female than if they are male. Male leads sell more tickets. And I don't know whether that's true or not, because the Underworld franchise seems to do okay.
Right.
That's the common wisdom. That's what everybody adheres to. That's like,
and who told you that? A man.
Actually, a woman told me that too. I've gotten that from a woman as well.
Yeah, but you didn't really listen when she talked, though.
Comics. Centralia is the basis for the fictional town of Blossomville, Pennsylvania, in Alan Moore's saga of the Swamp Thing in the 1985 story arc, The Nuke Face Papers.
Oh, The Centralia really kind of like hit a chord with a bunch of people, didn't it?
It's almost like it got set on fire underground.
and burned for 20 years and is set to burn for 200 more.
Yeah, it also appears in Action Comics number 558 as Superman comes to Coal Town to use his heat vision to make a fire break and put the fire out.
So Superman saves Centralia.
Basically, yes.
So all Centralia needs is a Superman.
That's all they ever needed.
Oh, well.
Yeah, that's much more likely than just – or much more helpful than just moving out.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the Simpsons episode Marge versus the Monorail. Marge goes to North Haverbrook, the town Lyle Landley sold a monorail to before Springfield. She finds the town nearly deserted after the monorail crashed on its maiden voyage.
That is an outstanding episode. I love the fact that Homer becomes the chain driver.
Yeah, yeah.
I call the big one Bitey. Well, it looks like my work here is done.
You didn't do anything.
Oh, didn't I?
It's such a weird feeling to know you're alive. It's such an awful feeling. You're dying inside. And when you wake up, startled to say, I hope I don't go crazy today. It's such a bad feeling. An ominous feeling. A feeling you know that we'll be back when the week is new. And we'll have more gross facts for you. And you'll have things you want to hear about. We will too.
Caustic Soda was recorded by Mike Leeson while being mentally controlled by a parasitic barnacle. To comment on episodes, make a donation, or see show notes, links, and videos, visit causticsodapodcast.com. Rate and review us on iTunes. Visit us on Facebook. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Caustic Podcast. Email us at info@causticsodapodcast.com.
I'm Leonard Nimoy. Good night.